First, I'd like to thank Chris for the invitation to be with you on this occasion in the summer series. It's always a pleasure. Then I'd like to thank the elders and this entire congregation for your financial support as I endeavor to teach in the Oklahoma City School of Biblical Studies. Your financial support, again, is greatly appreciated. Also, hope that all of you are finally on our mailing list. This is the new issue of One Heart, which you haven't received. It has not been in the mail as yet. Should be there this week or next week. And again, if you do not receive it, if you'll let Gary, I'll just pick on him. If you'll let Gary know, he can pass that on to me. Again, we have your directory, and we've tried to, again, get everyone in there, but it's possible that we've missed some. This is a paper that is a part of our school effort, so therefore it's part of your effort. It is a teaching tool, but it also serves as an advertising for the school, so it's at least a two-purpose paper. Chris and I talked the other day, and in the conversation I mentioned that this last Father's Day I had set a new tradition. You know, as parents, we always expect cards or something from our children. I thought this year that I would send my children a card. And so I did. And I put in that card a spiritual message. And I thought you might, Mother's Day, you mothers can do the same thing. You fathers, you might want to enlarge this concept and start a new family tradition of your own, sending your children a Mother's Day card or a Father's Day card. And again, with something you'd like to say from you to them. I just wanted to throw that in. It won't fit later, so I had to do it now. Also, I have been under increasing pressure in the sense that I have heard so many good things about those who had gone before me. When Chris called me up, he gave me the opportunity of choosing the date, and I had several things I had to work around, and I wound up on July 30th, and I didn't think that about all those who had gone before me and that what I said was going to be measured, but I've been told that by those who I drink coffee with, that I'm going to be measured by them. And, you know, that's a lot of pressure for a young man to live under. Now, I know you're saying, young man, I drink coffee with Bill McDonald and Ralph Pippen. And in that context, I'm a young man. Gary's even younger. I do want to, again, talk tonight in line with what Chris has said. This is an unusual lesson, and it's the only lesson I have that's even remotely like it. I've preached it a time or two through the years, and it has been received favorably, and I trust it will tonight. I'd like to take you back to the first century, to the year AD 33, in the city of Jerusalem. And I want to use a first-person narrative towards a little bit later. We have a background we need to get first in the events that unfolded on the occasion. No event in all of history of mankind is equal to the event at which we're going to discuss. As a matter of fact, all of mankind had waited for this one event. Some were waiting for just a good time or a better time. Others were waiting for that prophet. They were waiting for the Messiah. Some were even waiting for Elijah. They had a good deal of Bible knowledge. And so they were waiting for these people to come, but their minds were on deliverance. They wanted to be delivered. But here their thinking was not as it should have been. They were thinking about physical deliverance. Remember, they were under Roman bondage. The hatred of Romans and that bondage. So their minds were up on physical things and not spiritual, and this played a detrimental role in their ability to understand and to accept Jesus Christ as who He really was. They had read in the Old Testament about God's promise, and they had read passage after passage, and I want to read just a few of those to get us in the concept of what I'm talking about. They had read in their scrolls as they unfolded them in the synagogue and then privately, Genesis 3 verse 15, "And I will put enmity between me," that is, God is talking to Satan, "and so I will put enmity between thee," Satan, "and the woman," and that would be Eve, and between thy seed and her seed, and thou shalt bruise his head, and he shall bruise thy heel." Now I got that backwards, if you were looking carefully. "It shall bruise," or "he shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel." It does pay to have your Bibles open. Now what do they make of that? Well, people that even today do not know what to make of that. But they were more familiar with Genesis 12, verse 2 and 3. God speaking to Abraham, "And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed." Now they understood the idea about a great nation. That was Israel. They understood about Abraham having a great name. He was Father Abraham. I don't know what they thought about, "In thy seed shall all nations of the earth be blessed," because you see, that's spiritual and the rest of it's physical, and that they understood. So I'm not sure how well they understood that part of it. It appears they didn't understand it well. They were sure that God had promised them deliverance, and again, they were thinking physical and not spiritual, and again, that served as a detriment, not a help. They also had read Deuteronomy 18, verse 8, or verse 18. God said, "I will raise up unto them a prophet from among their brethren, like unto thee," speaking to Moses, "and will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak unto them all that I have shall command." This prophet was going to be like Moses, and he was going to speak the words of God which he had commanded. Again, they were aware of that. And then there was one other passage that I call your attention to that some were aware of. We would think it kind of obscure, but to them, again, it wasn't. And that's in the last book of the Old Testament, in Malachi chapter 4, verse 5. And we even wrestled around with the meaning of it. "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of Jehovah." Now, when John, the one who baptized, arrives on the scene, and he is preaching and he is baptizing, and the Jews are sure he must be the one. Why else is he doing all this? And so they sent out priests and Levites to inquire of him in a way of a number of questions. And this is in John chapter 1. It started in verse 19. First they asked John, "Who art thou?" It appears to me from reading that text, though it's not stated there, that they may have actually asked him, "Art thou the Christ?" Because he answers, "I am not the Christ." Now, you usually don't answer questions you're not asked. Sometimes you do. But it would appear to me either they actually asked John that question, or John, again, was able to know what was in their minds, because he said, "I am not the Christ." Second, knowing the Old Testament, they ask him, "Art thou Elias or Elijah?" To which John answered, "I am not." Now they're beginning to get uneasy. You see, John has all of Israel and Judea's attention, and he is baptizing, well, almost all of them. And if he's not the Christ, and he's not Elijah, well, they have one more shot at it. "Art thou that prophet?" And John said, "No." Well, now they don't know what to think. One of the mistakes they made, they did not know that the prophet and the Christ would be one person. And so they were looking for three people: that prophet, the Christ, and Elijah. And John was none of them, and so they must be still looking. But they still wanted to know something about John. They wanted to know who he was. And so they asked him, "Who art thou?" And in verse 23, he answers, "I am the voice of one crying in the wilderness, make straight the way of the Lord, as the prophet Isaiah has said." Isaiah. It appears that they didn't put much stock in the voice crying in the wilderness. In verse 25, since he's not the prophet, he's not the Christ, and he's not Elijah. Now, he was Elijah in power and spirit, but he wasn't Elijah resurrected or reincarnated. So he honestly answered, "No, I'm not Elijah." But being neither of those, They ask him in verse 25, "Why baptizest thou then, if thou art not the Christ, nor Elias, nor that prophet?" They're asking him about authority. By what authority are you baptizing? You're not one of these, and we're looking for one of them, and they're the only three we're looking for, and you're not one of them. So again, it means to me they didn't put much stock in the voice crying in the wilderness. Even though he had everybody's attention and he was baptizing again by the hundreds of the thousands, they weren't too interested in him. Not the priests and the Levites now. It is in the midst of all of this that Jesus of Nazareth arrives on the scene. First, he is baptized of John himself to fulfill all righteousness. Second, he teaches in their synagogue and they take notice of his teaching. And you might be aware, at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, it says in Matthew 7 and verse 28, I believe, the same words that we're going to read here, except this is not connected to the Sermon on the Mount. This is in a synagogue. In Mark 1, verse 22, "And they were astonished at his doctrine, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes." So it wasn't just on one occasion that they were astonished at his teaching, but it seemed almost always that they were amazed, because he didn't teach them the way everybody else taught. He taught one as having actual authority. In the Sermon on the Mount, he kept saying, "But I say." Now you have heard, referring to their traditions, not to the Old Testament. You have heard, "But I say." Now that's authority. And they noticed that authority, and they took note of that authority. Third, his fame in healing the sick was spread abroad throughout all the regions of Galilee and then Judea and then throughout the whole realm. Fourth, he fed the multitudes. And again, Jesus' fame is increasing. And people are following him, and again, for various reasons, primarily the food and the miracles. But they knew he taught them a little differently than others. He taught them as one having authority. Fourth, Jesus fed the hungry multitudes. Fifth, Jesus makes this triumphant entry into Jerusalem, riding upon, as we might say, the donkey. They took their outer garments and they laid them in the way, and they took the palm leaves and they put them in the way, and we would say this is the red carpet treatment. You know, this must be either the prophet or the Christ or Elijah. Again, they're not quite sure. And when they question him a bit later, they don't like his answer, because he answers them more than what they wanted to hear. But his fame is increasing. And again, they can't get enough of him. And so he rides in again as the triumphant, what, king. He must be the Christ. The word Messiah and the word Christ are simply the same, one Hebrew, one Greek, meaning anointed. He is the anointed, and who do you anoint? You anoint a king. Remember, they're wanting physical deliverance from the Romans, and they are willing to accept him as their king if he is going to deliver them from the Romans. Again, they are still thinking physical. They are thinking earthly king. They are thinking deliverance from the hated Romans. And so they are willing to accept him. Not only are they willing to accept him, but in John chapter 6, verse 15, we read, "When Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him king, he departed again into a mountain himself alone." Not only were they willing to crown him as he triumphantly entered Jerusalem, but he refusing to be received that anointed from them, they were going to take him by force and make him their king. Make him their deliverer. And again, deliverer in the physical sense. Jesus now turns the nature of things upside down. And when he does that, the whole scene changes. Now have led up to the point where they are ready to take Jesus by force to make him king. He is that well perceived. But when he turns the subject from the physical to the spiritual, the whole scene again changes. In John 6, verse 55 and 56, he said this, My flesh is meat indeed, and my blood is drink indeed. He that eateth my flesh and drinketh my blood dwelleth in me, and I in him. That they're not willing to accept. Notice the reaction to this spiritual change in John 6:60. Many therefore of his disciples went back and when they heard this, and they said, "This is a hard saying, and who can hear it?" Now Jesus is not talking about eating his literal flesh and drinking his literal blood. He's talking about his teaching. And again, he has changed the subject from the physical deliverance. He's saying, "I'm not a physical deliverer. I'm not a physical king to dwell in Jerusalem and to free you from the Romans. No, I come with spiritual food from that manna from in heaven." The result of this change in nature of the subject is in verse 66. From that time, many of his disciples went back and walked no more with him. I want you to understand the sadness of that. Just a few days earlier, let's say, the red carpet treatment, wanted to take him by force to make him king, and now they will not walk with him anymore. Jesus even turned to his disciples, that is, which would be the 12, and he said, "Will you also go away?" So sad was he. "Will you also go away?" Of course, Peter answers no. But talk about a change. A change in attitude. From taking Jesus again by force to make him king to deliver them from the Romans to now walking no more with him. They want nothing else to do with him. Well, the stage is now set for the unfolding of the events that lead to Jerusalem again in AD 33. One of Jesus' own, Judas Iscariot, now goes to the chief priest. And what is his purpose? Now remember, earlier some of his disciples would not walk with him anymore. They didn't want to hear his teaching. But though he taught one as having authority, they wanted nothing to do with that. They didn't want to hear it. And now one of his own chosen of the 12, now goes to the chief priest. And what is his purpose? We all know what his purpose is. In Matthew 26, verse 15, "And said unto them, What will you give me? And I will deliver him unto you. And they coveted with him for 30 pieces of silver." 30 pieces of silver. Remember, they followed him. His fame was everywhere. "We'll take him by force to make him king. Even if he doesn't want to be king, we'll make him king." And now one of his own betrays him. Things have changed that drastically in a very short period of time. In Matthew 26:16, it says, "From that time forth, Judas sought opportunity to betray him." He looked for the opportune time, the place by which he could betray Jesus. The events to which mankind have been slowly walking through the centuries is about to take place. It is time for the Passover of the Jews, and therefore Jesus and his disciples prepare to eat the Passover. In John 13, verse 2, and the supper being ended, and that is the Passover, the devil having now put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, the scene is all set. And it is here that I want to put in the first person narrative. I want to be on the scene. I want to hear and to watch what takes place. And so I will use the I. Again, the time is 33 AD in Jerusalem. It is a Friday. And I arrive in Jerusalem. It is early morning of Friday. And I want you to know what I saw and what I heard. But before I do that, I want you to understand just three things. One, I'm not a Jew. Second, I'm just a bystander. I don't have anything to do with any of the events that I'm about to talk about. I'm disconnected. The city of Jerusalem is busy. People are talking, people are going here and there, but it's not about the normal activities. No, this is different. So naturally, I ask the question, what's taking place? First, I learned that Jesus of Nazareth, meaning a man from Nazareth of Galilee, had been taken to both the high priest. Now, it's important that you understand that they had two high priests at this time. The law of Moses authorized one, but they had two. And this shows you the conditions and the state of mind of that time among the Jews. Annas was the high priest according to the law of Moses, and again, he served until death, and he wasn't dead, and he wasn't no longer the high priest either. But the Romans didn't like Annas, and so they replaced him with Caiaphas, I believe his son-in-law. And so this is how they came to have two high priests, and so you read priest as plural. But Jesus had been taken out of both of them, and there's a reason for this. These Jews, with their hierarchy, they wanted to appear to do things legally. So they go to Annas, the high priest according to the law of Moses. And they go to Caiaphas, the high priest according to the Romans. The Jewish authority and the Roman authority. Now, they're both going to be satisfied if they can get a conviction in this case. Jesus is the one they want to convict. So that's the reason for all of that. So they're going to relieve their minds now by simply taking Jesus to Annas, the high priest according to the law of Moses, to Caiaphas, the high priest according to the law of the Romans. Now, as a bystander, this gave me the appearance of being very legal. Does it not to you? They also took him before the great court of the Jews, the Sanhedrin. And so I'm impressed as a bystander. Again, I don't have anything to do with these events, and I'm not a Jew. But then I heard Jesus being charged as a blasphemer. Now that word got my attention. How often do you hear that? Jesus is a blasphemer. Well, I thought, blasphemer of what? And what's the consequences of being a blasphemer if he's found guilty? Well, why was he charged with that? That's because the high priest had asked him, whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God. You see, it was all right to be the Christ. Now, they wanted him to be the Christ, the Messiah, the Anointed. They wanted him to be king earlier, not now. But how dare he say he's the Son of God? He answered this, thou hast said, nevertheless, I say unto you, hereafter shall you see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power, and that's God, and coming in the clouds of heaven. At this point, now to my surprise, the priest, acting as a lawyer, and I mean no offense to any lawyers or judges, former lawyers, rent his clothes. Now all Jesus said was, thou sayest. In other words, you have said it correctly, and they understood it. He rent his clothes, saying, he has spoken blasphemy. What further need have we of witnesses? Behold, now we have heard his blasphemy. You don't need witnesses. Now, even as a bystander, not a Jew, I begin to become uneasy. Things weren't just right. Then the high priest turns to the jury, so to speak, and it's actually the court. And he says, what think ye? Now, the high priest had already announced, and he's the man in authority, he'd already announced he's a blasphemer. And now he turns to the weakling ones and he says, "What think ye?" Would they dare disagree? No, they replied, "He is guilty of death," meaning he has committed such a crime that he deserves to be put to death. I remind you, I'm not a Jew. I'm just a bystander. I just happened along, and I don't have anything to do with any of these events. But I couldn't see this as being just quite according to the law. And it lingered in my mind. It wouldn't go away. Third, early Friday morning, the priest, again both of them, Annas and Caiaphas, and the elders of the people took counsel of how to put Jesus to death. Now again, I became aware of this, and this puzzled me as well. Why do you have to take a counsel in order to enact a just sentence? Well, they did. And that again reminded me, maybe this is not just. That is, it's not justice. Again, I lingered and I wondered. The Jews were not under, or the Jews were under the yoke of the Roman law, and they were not allowed, though sometimes they did, put someone to death. You remember Stephen. But they were not allowed to do it legally. And so they had to use the Roman authority. And this is what they were consulting about, apparently. We want to put Jesus to death, but we can't do it, and so we're going to have to persuade the Roman authorities to do it for us. And how are we going to go about that? They take Jesus of Nazareth to Pontius Pilate, the governor, the Roman authority, legality. And it is here that I became aware that Jesus of Nazareth was actually a good citizen. He didn't lead any insurrection. He didn't cause people to commit crime. He simply went about teaching and performing miracles. He was no leader of rebellion, though some seem to think so. So I began to question again the honesty of these Jewish leaders. And I wondered, what evil hath he done that merited the death penalty? You see, I'm seeking for justice, and I'm not finding it. So I began again to question their honesty. I asked around and received no answer that would justify putting Jesus to death. When I said, "What has he done?" Again, nobody had a good answer. Not an answer that would merit death. Again, I cried out for just a little bit of justice. But remember, I'm just a bystander. I don't have anything to do with these events. It was with an eye toward justice, having realized that there had been no justice in the Jewish court for this Jesus of Nazareth. Therefore, I personally went to the Roman court. I stood before Pontius Pilate. I wanted to see Roman law in its purest form. Pilate seemed like a reasonable man. Again, I'm not a Jew, and I just happened to be passing through, so I don't know a lot about it. But he seemed like a reasonable man, and therefore I thought he had no reason to lean toward the direction of trying to please the Jews. Now, there were reasons, but I didn't know them. Pilate began questioning Jesus. He asked, "Art thou the king of the Jews?" Now he had heard about that. After a few words, Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight, and I would not be delivered to the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from hence?" He is saying, "My kingdom is spiritual, not physical." Now, why is that important to our narrative? Because Jesus was no threat to the Romans. They were very physical and not so spiritual. And his kingdom was spiritual. It wasn't of this world. He was not going to fight for territory. He didn't want an army. He said, "If my kingdom were here, then my soldiers would fight, but they're not." And so they did not fight. Now, Peter did draw his sword, you remember earlier, and cut off the ear of Malchus, the servant of the high priest, Jesus put it back on and told him to put up his sword. Again, indicating that his kingdom is not of this world, it's spiritual, not physical. So he was no threat to the Romans. And I thought, justice? Jesus had answered well. But following Pilate's questioning of Jesus, he announced, I find no fault in him at all. And you can imagine how relieved I felt, having heard these words from Pilate, the authority of the Romans. I don't find any fault in this Jesus of Nazareth, the man you want to kill and put to death. And you want me to sentence him to death. I don't find any fault in him. Not at all. And my mind went with ease and peace, justice at last. I thought I could see Pilate releasing Jesus and letting him go. However, to my surprise, Pilate had learned somewhere in the process that Herod was in Jerusalem and that Jesus of Nazareth of Galilee, and Herod was the governor of Galilee, and so Jesus was under his jurisdiction, technically. And I put that in technically. He was in Jerusalem under Herod's jurisdiction at the time. And so Pilate, trying to relieve himself out of this problem he had, sent Jesus to Herod. And I thought, well, this is good. I don't know Herod, but he probably a just kind of guy. Now, other people might know he wasn't, but I didn't. I thought Herod would just release Jesus, and that would be the end of the whole thing, and we'd all go home. Well, Herod was glad to see Jesus because he had desired to see him for a number of days. Herod questioned Jesus, but Jesus gave no answers. And maybe that didn't sit well with Herod. He is an authority, after all. As I looked around, there stood the priest, both of them, and along with the scribes, and they vehemently accused Jesus before Herod. But Herod examined Jesus and found no fault of death in him. And my heart trembled as I saw what Herod and his men did to Jesus. Now, finding no fault with someone, you think you release them or you don't do anything to them. But no, the soldiers acted with brutality. First, they set Jesus at naught, and that's an interesting word. It means to treat with utter contempt, despise. And what did they do to show this contempt of Jesus? The soldiers mocked him. They put a crown of thorns on his head, and they didn't just gently set it upon his head. They wanted it to stay, and so they pushed the thorns into his head, and his head began to bleed. And you know how the head bleeds rather freely, and the blood flowed down. They put a gorgeous robe, a purple robe, a royal robe upon him, and they mocked him, and they spit upon him, and they hit him. Now this is when they find no fault in him. And I thought, what else? Where is justice? Once more, I saw no justice for this Jesus of Nazareth. And third, Herod sent Jesus back to Pilate. And all the time, though I am not a Jew, I'm just a bystander, and I have nothing to do with this, I keep crying out, where is the justice for this Jesus of Pilate will find a notorious bad guy, and he will put him before the people, and they can't help but choose him and let Jesus go. And he did. He chose a notorious, well-known criminal, a robber, a murderer, a leader of insurrection. And my heart just jumped for joy. How could they possibly select this man and crucify Jesus? Pilate, still willing to release Jesus, spoke again unto them. But he chose the man Barabbas. You remember him? And Pilate set Barabbas before them, and he says, make your choice. And they said, give us Barabbas. My heart sunk. Now, I had seen injustices before, but nothing like this. There would be no justice for this Jesus of Nazareth. But Pilate, willing to release him again, said, you know, what evil hath he done? And they cried out, crucify him, crucify him. But Pilate has Jesus scourged, and I saw the flesh ripped from his back and the blood flowing freely. The scourging alone was the cause of many people's death, but Jesus survived it. Pilate questioned a third time, why, what evil hath he done? I have found no fault of death or cause of death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go. And I thought, maybe justice at last. But instantly, upon hearing Pilate's words, I can still hear the cry even today. They require Jesus to be crucified. They cry it out, crucify him, crucify him. And to my amazement, remember, I'm not a Jew. I'm just a bystander. I don't have anything to do with any of this. But to my amazement, and I still can't believe it. But all of this, Pilate takes water and washes his hands and said, I'm innocent from the blood of this just person. How do you set aside justice by washing your hands and making some kind of announcement? Oh, I saw no justice, but my heart cried for justice. But it was Pilate's last words, again, that echo through the centuries since, and I cannot forget them. He turned to that maddening mob, and he said to them, see ye to it. And with that, Pilate destroyed all sense of justice for this Jesus of Nazareth. But I kept telling myself, I'm not a Jew. I'm just a bystander. I had nothing to do with it. But then I cried out, no, no. I'm not just a bystander. I'm the reason this Jesus of Nazareth must die. It is my sins that cry out for the blood of Jesus. It was their words that cried, let him be crucified, let him be crucified. But it was my sins that said it more loudly than any of them. Isaiah had said it long before in chapter 53, verse 5. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. And the chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. I trust that you will never look at the scene of Jesus' crucifixion lightly. I trust that you will understand it's your sins that demanded his death. My sins. No, I'm not just a bystander. I am personally involved. My sins cried, let him be crucified, that I might be justified. Thank you.